Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Namaste Radio. The intent of our programming is to increase awareness, inspire loving action, and ignite transformation and healing in our listeners, and through them, our world. Namaste Radio is brought to you by Namaste Publishing. Please join its interactive spiritual community. Communicate directly with authors, guest bloggers, and others like yourself who are spiritually seeking a better way of living. Connect, make friends, and be one with our new Namaste Global community at namastepublishing.com. And now, please welcome your host for this hour, Marie Bernard, on Namaste Radio, radio that will change your life.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Namaste Radio. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. Thanks so much for being with us today. And we have a very special guest, one of our favorite guests of Namaste Radio, David Sarita. He's always very hugely popular, has some amazing ideas and insights. And in the last little while, he's been working on some really cutting edge, cool new stuff. Faster than light communication, pyramid technology. As always, he works with crystals and can talk more about that. So welcome to the show, David.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me on today.
Thank you. So you sent me a PDF of what you've been working on, and I mean it looks like a huge amount of information. The first thing that I noticed is the faster than light crystal light source with the laser beam, and it kind of reminds me of something that I'd heard about back in when I was like in seventh grade. Scientists were talking about using laser beams to try and travel much more quickly through space. Is this the same kind of concept, or is it something different?
No, that's something different because, I mean, everything now in the media is trying to challenge Einstein's view that nothing can go faster than light. And, you know, if God was limited to radio waves traveling at the speed of light, you know, you really couldn't communicate anywhere in the universe very effectively. It would take you, you know, about 8.7 years just to get a message from the star system Sirius to Earth, and twice that long for messages to go back and forth. And a distant and galaxy like Andromeda is literally hundreds of millions of light years away from us. So star systems like the Pleiades are about 440 light years away, and if you look up in the night sky these days in the Western Hemisphere, you can see Orion's belt in the Pleiades, and Orion's belt is over 1,000 light years away. So you're talking, the speed of light is so slow when it comes to cosmic communication mm-hmm. that there has to be a solution to the riddle, and there have been a lot of mysterious, you know, cutting-edge paranormal physicists and scientists that have discovered or accidentally discovered faster-than-light communication. But for the mainstream physics community to admit that anything's going on has taken an awfully long time, and they finally are starting to admit.
And so I'm curious now, you mentioned also that SETI, which is an organization, a nonprofit organization that is using satellites at NASA to try and track and see if there's any messages from outer space, but they're listening for stuff that's moving at the speed of sound, which would take millions of years to get a message to us.
Yeah, no, SETI's looking at radio waves, the speed of light, 100,
oh, okay.
Well, 300, approximately 300,000 kilometers per second. So very, very slow in cosmic terms, and they haven't yielded any positive results, and it's amazing to me that they've monopolized most of the funding in that area, in a very serious scientific arena of looking for extraterrestrial signals. They haven't really noticed what's going on in quantum physics to understand that there are major breakthroughs there where very small systems could be built to produce faster-than-light signaling. So what I've done is I've built a thesis that the Great Pyramids were giant crystal oscillators used to produce faster-than-light signals to the various star systems that those pyramid sets represent. And the pyramid set in Giza, the main, you know, what's known as the Great Pyramid and the two other pyramids next to it, are in the exact ratio of the distant star system of Orion's belt. And those stars are over 1,000 light years away. So there's no way that you could send a message to those star systems unless you were using faster than light signaling. And it started to happen. The first experiment was actually in the 1990s at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. A physicist named Dr. Raymond Chow, whom I actually spoke to about his experiment at great length, he didn't seem to know why it was happening, but using what's known as a down conversion crystal white source and two mirrors, he was able to send out the same beam of light into two different locations, bouncing off of two mirrors. And one of them goes through a thin, thin sheet of silica, which is quartz crystal, and another one doesn't go through that. And the one that goes through the quartz crystal accelerates to the target at 1.7 times the speed of light. And that is utterly phenomenal. And so what I did, as I said, what is actually causing that to happen? It's a process called quantum tunneling. And if you can imagine a light wave kind of bouncing up and down on a two-dimensional plane and has a certain width to it, when it approaches the silica barrier, it's forced to go into a narrower focus. And it's because of the geometries inside of the quartz crystal, known as the crystal lattice geometries, that causes that to happen. And in silica, the actual lattice structure geometry is a tetrahedron pyramid, which is a three-sided pyramid, three-dimensional three-sided pyramid. And I said, I wonder why that is causing the wavelength or the diameter of the wave to shrink into a narrow tunnel and quantum tunnel through it and accelerate faster than light. Well, if you look at the base of a two-dimensional pyramid, a triangle, and you imagine that is the width of a wave, and as it gets closer to the peak, the apex, it's compressing the wave into ultra, ultra high frequency oscillations. And then that's where the faster than light signal is being generated. But then a more stunning experiment was done, far more stunning, at Princeton University. It's a really amazing experiment done by Dr. Lijun Wang at Princeton. He sends, a crystal white source laser. They actually use several lasers in this experiment, through cesium gas. And cesium is, of course, radioactive. And the signal generated went 300 times the speed of light. Now, that is unbelievably fast.
Wow.
And this was, again, this was actually all over the news. It was on NBC News in 2007, 2008, in that era. So this is still a while ago. And nobody seemed to notice, what this meant, that at the NEC Princeton lab, they had done this. Well, that means that you can send signals to very distant star systems in a very small amount of time. But
now, David, I'm just going to interrupt you for a moment. What about, would that impact us receiving messages as well?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But when you look again at the geometry of the cesium chloride gas, it's four-sided pyramids. All in what is known as a cubic face geometry. So there's actually six pyramids all facing each other from all six sides of a cube.
And you're talking about the molecular structure.
You're talking about the molecular crystal lattice structure.
Okay.
And the same thing is happening when a light wave approaches this, six-sided pyramid cube, the waves compress in the center and they actually collapse into a quantum tunneling effect, and they go faster than light. So I looked at the Great Pyramids and said, well, I had already built a thesis that they were crystal oscillators, but I didn't really get it at the time that the function of the crystal oscillations is to send messages or possibly build a stargate to move something physically to that distant point. And it gets really, really fascinating when you start to look at what are the materials of the Great Pyramid. And the materials of the pyramid are multi-layered crystal. You have granite, a pink granite core, where the King and Queen's Chambers are in the Grand Gallery. Then that's surrounded by a limestone blocks. The majority of the blocks in the pyramid are a type of limestone that possesses It's called dolomite limestone, and it possesses the metallic, you know, qualities of minerals, magnesium and other minerals, that make it pretty much the same thing as a giant transistor. You know, transistors are little crystal devices that are in our laptop computers and our cell phones, and they amplify very, very weak information and signals to allow us to have long-distance telephone calls and these sort of things. We never had long-distance telephone calls before the transistor was developed. And the transistor was developed in 1947 by three scientists, John Bardeen and William Bratton and Will Shockley, built this little crystal device that changed the whole world and changed all of telecommunications forever. So my thesis is, why wouldn't a very large-scale crystal oscillator have these kind of electronic properties to vibrate frequencies so high, so ultra-high, that they could send them faster than light? Well, the geometries are the same in all the faster-than-light experiments that we just mentioned, both at Princeton and Berkeley, as the shape and the design of the pyramid. So the pyramid has, in a transistor, you have to have multi-layers of crystal and conductor or mineral material, like gold or silver or magnesium or these type of materials. And that's how the pyramids are built. They're built in these three layers. And then it was, you know, very famous people like Jim Hancock and Robert Bovall noticed that the pyramids all over the world were built in ratios of distant star systems. And their thesis was, well, this is just a map. It's a map on the ground to demonstrate that, yet we're doing this as an artistic rendering of what we're seeing in space. And we're philosophizing that our gods and goddesses are from those star systems. But those people never set forth the idea that the pyramids were actually electronic devices that were sending and receiving either messages or stargating physical persons through it to those distant points in time. That's a very, very new idea that I've come up with, and I presented recently at the International UFO Congress in Scottsdale, Arizona, in February of this year. So the idea is very well received, and it's now really evolving. I have actually built technology myself based on this thesis, and we have done the same thing with a very small device using the exact harmonics of a distant star systems. I actually sent messages to the Pleiades several times and gotten a response every time I've done it. And that
sounds...
So when
you say you've received a response, what exactly do you mean?
Well, I received every single time I received a response when I sent messages out. The idea that we have to have these big radio telescopes and hundreds of millions of dollars going into them to listen for extraterrestrial signals that are only traveling at the speed of light, to me is really amazing when we consider that quantum physicists have known for years about Einstein's spooky action at a distance phenomena, where you can separate two components of an atom, or even two atoms, and separate them over any distance, and they will communicate with each other faster than light speed. It's called action at a distance. And scientists have known that you can separate the electron and the positron, two subcomponents of each other inside of the atom, and they do the same thing. A German physicist named Fritz Albert Popp discovered that plants and all living things, including humans, emit biophotons of light, particles of light, that emanate from the DNA of all living things, and that those transmissions and receptions are faster than light. So we all have within us the same components as a cell phone and a cell phone tower. We have everything. Our bones are made of silica. They're made of phosphorus and calcium. And calcium is an electrolyte, and phosphorus and silica are essentially the same things in transistors. A transistor is a little slice of quartz crystal with a layer of phosphorus floating on the top of it and with a little bit of gold wire attached to it, you've got amplification, and you have long distance cell phone and telecommunications abilities and satellite communication abilities. I mean, Intel, the big computer company, started in the 70s with a chip that changed the world. It was very exciting when it was happening that they were doing this, but their first chips had about 2,300 transistors on them. 2,300 transistors in a single chip. And those transistors are quartz crystal. And today, we have over 2.3 billion transistors on a single Intel chip. And each one of those transistors, which you can't even see, they're the size of cells, has a function to produce color and sound and picture and transmission on your little iPad or your computer. So what, you know, as you know from some of the last shows we've done, I talked about a little bit about my pendants, which are crystal chips that are programmed with harmonic frequencies, and we saw how we could raise the millivolts and the microamps of the human body. And we could see that on a voltmeter, and we could see that with aura cameras, that the person's aura was getting brighter by wearing this crystal pendant that has been harmonically treated. Well, the first transistors, and the transistors we use today, are weaker in amplifying signals than those little pendants are in amplifying the human body's energy field. Because the first transistors were a couple of milliwatts, which is a thousandth of a watt. But that was enough to hear the news on the radio long distance. With radio tubes and the very, very first transmissions of radio by Nikola Tesla and Marconi, you really couldn't hear very well at all what was going on. And now you can hear things perfectly clearly because of these little crystals. So what is a crystal oscillator? A crystal oscillator is a little piece of crystal with two pieces of metal on either side of it where you run electrical current through, passing between the geometries, the lattice geometries in the piece of crystal, and it produces frequencies, oscillations of frequencies. And that little device allowed us to have very, very accurate timing and watches. We've seen the little crystal oscillators, and it says, you know, quartz, you know, when you see your watch and it says quartz. There's a little tiny crystal quartz oscillator sitting inside of your watch that's keeping very, very accurate time. And the reason it does that is because the oscillator is oscillating at thousands of beats per second. And in those thousands of beats per second, you're measuring a single second. And you're saying, well, in thousands of beats per second, in keeping time in a whole year, my watch isn't even going to go out of phase out of a single second, even in a whole year, because my timing device is oscillating faster than a single second is. So things got higher and higher and higher frequency, and because of little pieces of crystal. And the smaller you got the crystals, the higher and higher the frequencies could go. But the problem was with the smaller, tiny electronic devices and tiny crystal oscillators and tiny transistors is the signal was getting... Essentially, the ability to do what we want to do is send a very large amount of information into ultra, ultra, ultra high frequency geometries was not happening. They were obsessed with frequencies rather than harmonics. And harmonics are sets of frequencies, multiple frequencies that work together in a set of... It's kind of like listening to a single violin versus a whole symphony of different instruments all working together perfectly. And harmonics have the ability to travel faster than light, because harmonics, every location in the universe, every star system, every planet has its own very, very precise set of harmonics. And once you can produce a signal or a set of signals that are in the exact ratio of the harmonics of a distant star system or distant planet, the quantum universe knows and recognizes only that signal as being relative to that position that you're going to send it to. And this is where the Great Pyramid gets much more complicated. At Cambridge University, just this year, scientists quantum entangled two diamonds, rocks, and they separated them, and they're now talking to each other faster than light speed. Two rocks, two crystals, diamonds. How the heck is that possible? How the heck can two rocks memorize the same harmonic set of vibrations, and then you separate them, and no matter where you put them, they're talking to each other faster than light speed? Well, what determines quantum entanglement? What are the parameters of quantum entanglement? Are all of the harmonic frequencies in a certain set of subatomic particles, or even something larger than that, a diamond or a crystal? And harmonic sets are just different. They're really, it's not just frequencies, it's the arrangement and the proper ratios of those frequencies. What I did this year, I spent many, many months in the middle of the night doing all of the math on all of the angles and sides of the Great Pyramid, which are all uneven. And I was able to calculate over 180 frequencies inside the Great Pyramid. Nobody's ever done this before, because nobody has seen the Great Pyramid as a crystal oscillator. And what's happening since I've done that is just nothing short of remarkable. I built a device, a transmitting crystal oscillator electromagnetic device, which we put into a flashlight tubing, and we have rubies and some very interesting geometries in our windings on the inside. And I signal generated those 180 pyramid frequencies, and you can see this on YouTube, what I'm talking about. If you go to my channel, Spaceman99, you'll just click on Spaceman99 and you'll see the pyramid frequencies being transmitted with less than 100 watts of power. And you'll see these four little ball magnets on dishes, and they're all just zipping around, traveling around. Really incredible, the significance of what that means.
So, David, what is the practical use, like if people get this wand, what's it going to do for them?
Well, I'll tell you. I mean, you can Google in Egypt the Dendera light, D-I-N-D-E-R-A light. And people thought this was a light bulb. There's a photograph on Wikipedia of this incredible giant tube with a coil inside of it, and you'll see this very large Egyptian god holding this device. And the Dendera light was thought to be a light bulb, but when I looked at it and I looked at the symbology of the coil inside, and you can see the cord going into this thing, you can see clearly what he's doing. He is holding this wand, which is about 8 feet long, probably, above the heads of humans, who are much smaller people. Those are not children sitting underneath it. And he's transmitting probably harmonic information into their bodies. Because, I mean, this is a really deep conspiracy theory, that when Adam and Eve were created, physically created, our DNA was cut off so that we couldn't access the higher functions of our brain. And this argument has been set forward by the history work of Zechariah Sitchin and the Earth Chronicles and many, many other ancient historians, that the reason we don't have powers of mind and we're so weak and it's so hard for us to meditate and we only use 5% of our brain or less is because our DNA has been cut off. We've lost access to the higher functions of our brain. You know, and I've been doing the meditation for 33 years now every day, and then I can go into deep bliss states and expanded states of consciousness, and I have some abilities, you know, to see the dead and to be able to see ghosts. But why is it that I can't levitate a rock with my mind? Why do we have so little ability? And what I believe is happening in this photo of the Dendera light is they are using this transmitter not only to activate oscillations inside of the Great Pyramid, but they're transmitting information into the recipient's DNA. And any good scientist today can tell you, from Bruce Lipton to William Tiller and many, many others in my films, that DNA responds to magnetic fields and magnetic impetus. And if you can put harmonic information, as I am, I'm putting the 180 frequencies of the Great Pyramid through the wand and transmitting it into the body. I'm doing the phi or the golden ratio frequencies into the body. I'm doing these beautiful infinity frequencies and putting them into the body. And people are having amazing experiences with this. I mean, we've had consistent out-of-body experiences using the device in our room before sleep, but I've noticed very large amounts of ecstasy in the upper crown chakra when I do about a 45-minute session with it. And when I first was doing it, I thought, you know, this can't be happening with a device like this. I mean, I am pulsing essentially mantras, and mantras are perfect words that have harmonic meaning in ancient languages. And we recite mantras in meditation over and over and over again and eventually produce bliss states. But I'm essentially putting the sounds of perfect mantra or frequencies together into word, which is logos, through this device, and I'm getting bliss states, really amazing bliss states. And I thought, maybe it's just me. Maybe it's just because I'm sensitive. So I sold one to a guy in eastern Canada, and he started using it, and he said, he wrote me back. He said, is it normal to experience this much ecstasy and expanded consciousness with this device? Like, he wasn't expecting that much to happen, and it did. And I thought, oh, my God, it's not just me. I mean, this person is a meditator. He's very sensitive. But it's very clear that this thing, you can see on the YouTube video at Spaceman99 with all my meters going crazy, this thing is transmitting a lot of power. And it's harmonic information. And I further believe the Dendera light bulb was used to start the oscillations in the Great Pyramid, because you need a source of vibrational energy to start oscillations in a crystal oscillator. And this was actually transmitting and activating the pyramids to get them to start vibrating and sending the energy fields to the distant star systems. And so that's what I believe was happening with that device. And the new one that I've developed is available. We sell them at the lightstreamtechnologies.com for $1,700 for people who want them. Now, these things have rubies in them, and they have tourmaline, very, very expensive, high-quality crystals we're using in our crystal oscillators, whereas some of the Rife frequency devices or other frequency devices you'll see out there have so little crystal in them, very, very cheap electronics made in the Far East that don't really have, even though the frequencies that Rife discovered are very true and accurate for combating certain diseases, there's just not enough power there in the crystal oscillations to really do anything. So, I mean, this is the most exciting thing about this to me, though, is that, you know, what is possible here with the pyramids and seeing that the pyramids were really something far greater than we can imagine. Why would these ancient peoples build a star map on the ground just for artistic purposes to demonstrate a understanding of a distant star and spend the enormous, enormous amount of labor and or technology needed to build something so mathematically flawless? I mean, the math in the Great Pyramids is so astounding, utterly, utterly astounding, that you would have to see Patrice Pouillard's new film on the Great Pyramids to really understand what has recently been discovered in the Great Pyramid, how unbelievably sophisticated the mathematics in that device really is. Patrick Flanagan wrote a book in the 1970s. He's a PhD scientist, called Pyramid Power, and his book is out of print. And I know Patrick. We've been talking. He's extremely excited about my discovery of decoding the frequencies in the Great Pyramid and understanding what they are, because we're going to really go into this now. This involves Jesus. It involves Moses. It involves Buddha. It involves all of the great masters. The effects of pyramids were tested by Patrick Flanagan with very, very rigorous controls. And what Flanagan did is he took just the shape and the correct dimensions of the pyramid, and he made paper pyramids, and he aligned his north face to magnetic north as well as to true north. And right now, magnetic north is drifting way out of northern Canada and heading towards Siberia very, very rapidly. And he found the most remarkable, unbelievably remarkable results. And before I tell you some of his results, he tested cubes and hexagons and all these other fancy sacred geometries, and none of them would do what pyramids would do. He would put small cardboard pyramids and put tomato inside of one, and in the same batch, another tomato sitting outside. And the one sitting outside would rot, and the one inside would not. It didn't rot. It didn't age as anywhere near as fast as the ones outside. He put the dead bodies of rats inside and outside, and the ones inside the paper pyramids mummified with no odor or bacteria. The ones outside were rotten and flies and maggots, and the ones inside, he found that maggots and certain microorganisms that were, if you will say, you know, disease-oriented, could not stand the vibration of the pyramids. He found you could put a razor blade inside of the pyramid and use it and shave every day, and it always stayed sharp, whereas the one outside did not stay sharp. And he did, you know, he did the mummification experiments on numerous types of decaying flesh and animals, little animals and little critters, and found that every single time he did it, he got the same results. That the mummification of living organisms and living persons was improved dramatically with the shape of the pyramid. It didn't need to be made out of rock or crystal or anything. He just made them out of paper. And then he did this little experiment where he took these tiny little grid-patterned pyramids and he ionized them, and he could see these cones of light jetting out of the top of the pyramid, which is exactly the point, the apex of the pyramid, where I'm suggesting on the crystal lattice scale, the faster-than-light communication experiments done at Princeton and Berkeley, the geometries compress the waves at the apex of the little crystal lattice pyramids, and that's where it goes faster than light. And there's this great photograph in his book, which I have in my PDF presentation. Well, on a website called earthfiles.com, run by Linda Moulton Howe, there is a man from who was in Central America several years ago, and he took a picture of the Yucatan pyramids during a lightning storm, and you can see this wispy little lightning strike in the background. And lo and behold, this cone of light was captured on his iPhone photograph, zipping out of the top of the pyramid, shooting out into space. Exactly the same as the photograph on Patrick Flanagan's little mini pyramids, showing the wave compression of the light at the cone of the pyramid and jetting out into space. I mean, this is incredible. I mean, what it shows is that the pyramids need to be ionized by a powerful electrical source, either naturally through a lightning strike or unnaturally through a transmitting device like the Dendera wand or light. And that scientists know that when you ionize crystal, the electrons, which are the carriers of the electric force, just like water drops flowing down a stream, hitting and turning a paddle, electrons flow down the core of a wire, a copper wire, and when they hit their target, they either cause friction or light or heat or some other form of electrical output. You need to, as soon as you ionize crystal, which is very different than ionizing metal, the electrons jump out of their shells and the atoms, and they're free to move. You have real oscillations of these orbits of these electrons in the crystal. So in a pyramid, the size of the ones at Giza, the amplitude or size of your signal, because of the base of the pyramid is so wide and there's so much semiconductive material in the pyramids are made out of, and because they're made out of three different layers of material, you set up voltage, which is movement of electricity. you have this enormous amount of power that would happen in a lightning storm or in the presence of an artificial ionizer that I believe far, far beyond the faster-than-light theory of sending just information to their to the distant gods. You have the ability to send a physical person in the passenger seat, the King's Chamber, to a target. And this is really an incredible hypothesis, because you're not going to believe where we're going to go next. Peter Lemizurier wrote an amazing book. In fact, one of the first spiritual books I ever read in Vancouver when I was, you know, just getting out of high school was The Great Pyramid Decoded by Peter Lemizurier. And this was one of the world's greatest mathematicians taking on the Great Pyramid. And what he finds is so much evidence that Jesus Christ was a student of the pyramid at the very least. That the pyramids predicted his birth, because on summer solstice there's a shadow that's cast out of the angles of the pyramid that runs right through the town of Bethlehem where Christ was born. And that a lot of the math that Jesus used in the Gospels, he must have borrowed from the dimensions of the Great Pyramid, because there's no other place that it could have existed. Like, for example, when Jesus fed the masses the 153 loaves and fishes. The Grand Gallery, which is the ascending gallery in the Great Pyramid, is 153 primitive inches, which is the unit of measure back then, which is very similar to our inch, times 12, which is, or 12 disciples. And you would see this math over and over and over again in the Gospels the more and the more you studied the Great Pyramids. And we realize that when Jesus was born and Herod's persecution of the innocents and the Holy Family, Joseph and Mary, had to escape the persecution and bring Jesus to Egypt where he was raised and probably studied and went to school. And there's no doubt we now know that his father was not only an architect, but he was a master builder, that of course he would have studied the Great Pyramids. And most likely back then, the pure white limestone casings were probably still on the outside of the pyramids during the time of Christ. So there's no question that he knew the more and more and more. In fact, if you read David Fidler's Jesus Christ, Son of God, he really builds the case for the math in the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And really shows you that there's no coincidence to the meaning in the symbology of the math. Well, the math that Jesus was teaching was all about architectures, and it all ultimately equates to the pyramid. And there's one other utterly astounding piece of information in a hidden gospel that connects Jesus to the Great Pyramid, and that is the Gospel of the Egyptians. The Gospel of the Egyptians is a legitimate Gnostic Christian gospel where Jesus is teaching students the seven sacred tones or vibrational sounds, which were vowels, and to enchant the seven vowels 22 times each as an exercise for meditation. Well, what's amazing is the Great Pyramid base, Two sides of the Great Pyramid's base divided by its height is Egyptian pi. And pi, you know, pi, little I, is the resolution of a circle. You take the diameter of a circle times pi and you get the distance around the circle. Well, 7 goes into 22, 3.14, which is pi, but then the rest of the numbers going down the decimal are slightly different than today's modern pi, which is the modern resolution of the circle. Now, why would Jesus in the Gospel of the Egyptians be talking about the seven sacred vowels when we know there's actually, in the Grand Gallery, there are seven major arcana of ascension in the geometries of the central channel of the ascending passage, that correspond, as I have done in the math on, to sound frequencies? Now, there actually are a total of 9 frequencies sets of major arcana frequencies from the base subterranean level of the pyramid to the base to the top. And I've calculated all the frequencies, 180 of them, all the way up the ascending levels of the pyramid. And when you convert those frequencies to metric, you know, the 10 based, you know, Canadian and European, French and European based mathematics, which the Great Pyramid used, you end up with the ability to slide your decimal down so you can scale the frequencies into the audible or hearing range of the human ear. And that's what I did. I scaled the frequencies down. And when you hear them, they're like they're the most beautiful ascending tones. I have these on a CD available for people. If they just write me at davidsarita@hotmail.com, you can buy the CD. They sound so beautiful. They're far more beautiful than the famous solfeggio tone scale frequencies. They're far more beautiful than the modern musical eight octaves, I believe, that, you know, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, those ones. You, when you hear these, you just go, oh, my God, these sounds are so incredibly beautiful. And because there are four different lengths on the sides of the Great Pyramids, the sounds, they oscillate. They pulse up and they pulse down, and they're really profound, profoundly affect human consciousness. So Jesus was teaching this in the Gospel of the Egyptians to enchant these seven tones 22 times, and 7 into 22 is Egyptian pi, which is the base, double the base of the Great Pyramid by its height. It's very clear that he learned and taught the seven sacred sounds from the Great Pyramid, because the first three sounds are subterranean, beneath the Great Pyramid. And when you get to the base, you're at four, because the first frequency of the base starts with the number four. I'm not going to give out the exact frequencies yet. I'm going to be producing a DVD on this. And then it goes from four all the way, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, when you get to the very height. And then you actually only go to 9 when you go to the top of the pyramid, because the pyramid doesn't have an apex. It's missing its apex, and there's a very symbolic reason for that. So you have this teaching coming from Jesus that clearly connects itself to the Great Pyramid, which nobody's ever discovered before. I'm saying it for the first time in history that there is that connection. And you have the frequencies of the Great Pyramid, when scaled into the audible spectrum, resemble those same seven sacred vowels. You have a teaching of these seven sacred vowels that lead to the ascension of consciousness, and you have a master, Jesus, who probably lived and meditated in the pyramid and was absorbed in its frequencies, just in the same way you have meditators today in India who sit in these caves for very many, many years, you know, meditating inside of these caves. Jesus was meditating inside of this perfect harmonic structure. Well, it's quite exciting, because there is also evidence that the Ark of the Covenant was from the inside of the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid. Mm-hmm. And that Moses, when he fled Egypt, he stole or took with him the transmitter that belongs in the middle of the Great Pyramid. And this is all the proof on this is done in the math. And I've done the math, and I know what Peter Lemizurier calls the master number. And I'm going to give this one frequency out, because this, according to Lemizurier, is the great, great master number. And it is the number of enlightenment, he believes. The length and the width of the Ark of the Covenant is sufficiently the correct size to fit just inside of the coffer inside of the King's Chamber. The King's Chamber length in primitive inches, which 0.0006 of an inch today, so it's very almost identical. You can barely see the difference unless you're looking at large numbers, is 51.51 inches long. What's amazing about that is when the pyramids had their limestone casings on it, the angle of the slope of the pyramid was 5151 degrees. Mm-hmm. 51.51 degrees, 0.143. Now, what's even more amazing about that, because that number, the 5151, according to Le Mesurier, is the master number of enlightenment. When I calculated the capstone square wave frequencies on the four sides of the pyramid on the top, the frequency was 5151 as a frequency. And all you do is you take your square and you take the full length of your square and divide it into the speed of light to get how many oscillations of electromagnetism per second. And so that's how you do it. Although there are so many different dimensions of the pyramid and the sides are uneven, you end up with all these different numbers for each side that are very slightly varying of each other. So the 5151 turns out to be the frequency of the capstone. And the 5151 is only one quarter of a base set of numbers that ends up being a frequency for the fifth level of the pyramid, actually, the fifth level.
So, David, these differences in measurements intentional, or is this just due to, like, wearing away over the years of the stone?
No. They're calculated. The way they did the math is they actually measured to where the limestone casings would have touched the ground. So you get an exact measurement in metric. And what's amazing in Patrice Pouillard's film, for example, you take the center of the pyramid from the top and you take a compass and you measure your radius to your corners and you draw a circle. And then you take your compass, measure it straight off your face, and you get a smaller circle. And then you take the circumference of both of those circles, and you subtract the small one out of the larger one, and you're left with the speed of light in metric, 299,000, you know, et cetera, you know, centimeters or millimeters per, depends on how big your scale is, but you end up with the same number of the speed of light in metric. So whoever built this thing, I mean, the more you go over the math everywhere, Le Mesurier has covered the whole thing, but he never saw it as a crystal oscillator, so he never determined its frequencies. And in Patrice Pouillard's new film on the Great Pyramid, you can see this mathematician. They don't show his head because he doesn't want anyone to know who he is. He's the one who shows you where the speed of light in metric is coded. So I wanted to know if he was right, and I redid all the math on all of the four sides of the pyramid. And I found out not only was he right, but there were four slightly variants of the speed of light, which were incredibly close to the true speed of light that we say today. And then I thought, well, why would there be four variants? And it's even more sophisticated than you can imagine, because when a light wave approaches a magnetic oscillator from different angles of the magnetic field, the field impinges on the light and slows it down or speeds it up ever so slightly. So whoever designed this thing was such a master. To, according to Le Mesurier, says that it actually prophesied the date and the birth of Christ, the birth of the Buddha, which is before Christ, 623 BC, and he believes it shows using one primitive inch in measurement to a year, I believe is his unit of measure in the book. He ends up seeing every major event that's happened in history, including what's about to happen on the planet, and when the next Messiah is going to return to the planet, when, you know, when the next avatar or Godhead is going to take birth. Well, whoever built this thing must have left their signature. And what's amazing about the signature, and I believe I'm the first one to find what I believe is the signature, is it equates to the star system of the Pleiades. And I believe the builders are from there, whoever built this thing. On March 21st, which is coming up in a few days, 2141 BC, the descending passage of into the Great Pyramid lines up with Alcyone, with a central star in the Pleiades. Now, what's amazing about 2141 BC and March 21st is that, well, that's apparently close to the date of I think it's Cheops, the Khufu, the who is it's said to be a tomb for Khufu, and I don't believe that for a minute. Not only does it prophesy probably the death of one of the great Egyptian kings, and certainly was not his burial tomb. Really, most people who study the math on the pyramids don't believe that, because all the pyramid is doing is prophesying great, you know, teachers and Osiris and Isis and all of the great masters coming into Buddha and Christ and all of them. It is giving us this number on spring solstice, March 21st, 2141 BC. The most common measurement throughout the pyramid, and you'll see this number constantly in Peter Lemizurier's book. It's everywhere. It's in the King's Chamber, Queen's Chamber, passages. It's 2 royal cubits, which equals the 4121, 41.21 primitive inches, which is the inverse of 2141 BC. And I believe the reason it's the most common measurement, it is because it's the signature of the inverse of where the builders were from. What's more astounding to me than anything is, how did the builder know? And this is perfect math. Lemizurier does perfect measurements. He tells you Christ is born at this time because it says so in the Great Pyramid. He's crucified. Here's the great messianic triangle in the ascending passage, and the Trinity of Christ, and why, you know, how the Trinity concept was invented, and all of the math Jesus taught was in it. And then you come to all these great epics in history, and you come to, and he wrote this book in the 70s, and I read this. It prophesied the great financial collapse. It says by the year 2025, we will see the total collapse of the materialist civilization. 2025. Now, is that going to be from natural catastrophes that slowly escalate, or is that going to be because we realize that materialist civilization is a money-based system and it's going to collapse? I don't know. The pyramid itself is not that specific, but I know I read this book in the late 70s, early 80s, so I know he didn't change anything in the book, and he's got his copyright book, and almost all of the prophecies that are in the book that he prophesied based on the pyramid's math have come true already.
So what do you think the difference is between 2025 and 2012, where we are right now?
Well, according, if I look at the pyramid, I'd say 2012 is kind of just things are really heating up. But we still have over another decade of collapse to occur, and that may mean a pole shift. It may mean a lot of things that are going to happen. And the new Messiah doesn't come until 20. There's supposed to be a big sign in the sky according to the pyramid, around 2037, 38. I'm just going off the top of my head because I don't have the book in front of me, but that's when Comet Apophis comes around, and we see it, this great, great comet. And that may be the heralding sign in the sky that the Messiah is about to be born, the new return of the Christos, or the Christ light in the body. And that comes after the total collapse of the civilization. So the pyramids are a mathematical archival of before and after known history. They are giant crystal oscillators that I'm saying have the ability to physically teleport a person to their distant target. And whoever built this, their math is so perfect, it's very clear that it's possible that Moses had the Ark of the Covenant, which people like John Hutchison in Canada have appeared on History Channel shows showing that was an electronic capacitor or ultra-powerful storage device for very strong electrical energy spikes, and that it could have been the power source that was used to ionize the pyramids to turn them on. Or there was a number of electrical devices, which is more likely the case. You would need an ionizer like the giant 8-foot wands we see in the Nidera light bulb photo, and you would also need a giant ultracapacitor, which was in the King's Chamber. And Moses probably had a relationship with these distant gods, and more likely when he stole it, the Egyptian armies pursued him because he took the power supply out of the pyramid. And these gods obviously liked Moses much more than they liked the Egyptian pharaoh at that time. And so when Moses was running around with it, he was able to communicate with them and get full physical responses to save the Jewish people of the time. And the fact that it probably worked even when it was not inside the pyramid, but the dimensions are so perfect, it looks like it fits very nicely with the long poles, a little extra room for the poles right inside of the coffer, which is 51.51 pyramid inches long, the inside of the King's Chamber coffer, and that is your master number. Now, I have that frequency and all the others on my pyramid frequency CD, and they're, when you listen to them, you can either listen to them sonically, or you can transmit them through my Lightstream wand, and as a magnetic transmitter, it's a much deeper experience to be around it. And I can put Fibonacci frequencies through my wand. I can put the golden phi. The golden phi frequencies are also proven to be everywhere inside of the pyramid, so I have those as well. And I have these infinities, which are really amazing, amazing frequencies to transmit. And we also transmit the sound of the sun through the wand as well. We can take any audio file and transmit it through it. So that's, you know, in a very simplified form, what I think the Great Pyramid, what they were used for. And they're not working anymore. They don't have an ionizer. When, just like the pyramids in the Yucatan, in fact, Wayne Herschel is one of my favorite new researchers, not a very well-known guy, but quite well-known, wrote a book called The Hidden Records, and he shows you further down the Nile River in Egypt, all of the pyramids that are in the same ratio as the Pleiades star system. He shows you the pyramids on Mars and superimposes the Pleiades star system right over them, and they fit perfectly. The pyramids at Tikal in Guatemala all line up in the perfect ratio of the Great Pyramid. And the mounds in England, not far from Stonehenge, all have the same ratio as Pleiades. In fact, he finds this over and over and over again over the planet. And Herschel's work is so incredible to suggest that even Cro-Magnon, in Cro-Magnon, France, there's the paintings on the walls, which, you know, historians thought a caveman was just painting bulls on the wall. He shows you, just look above the neck of the bulls, and you'll see the seven little dots in the same ratio as the Pleiades star system. And how could a primitive caveman know that the ancient philosophers all described in the House of Taurus, the astrological House of Taurus, the bull, that Pleiades are just above the neck of the bull, and the neck of the bull points the way to Pleiades? Well, he suggests Cro-Magnon were a race of very great beings that basically mutinied and were stuck here. Possibly they went through the Stargate of the pyramids, I don't know, and they couldn't get back, and they had no technology with them, nothing else to send them back, and they had to very, very frustratingly, you know, paint their story on these caves in France, and they were not in any way a unevolved humanoid. Hmm. They were very, very evolved. So, but, you know, Wayne Herschel, I mean, I've read his book, and his case for the Pleiades being the number one star system for pyramids to be built in the ratios or sets of has excited me, because I believe that they were built by them as stargates to bring themselves to and from their distant place. And so, you know, once again, I built a small device with the proper ratio and math and resonance of that star system and sent messages out to the Pleiades. Every time I've done it, we've had major, major things happen. But we would have to. I actually have a CD that explains the whole experiences about what happened there. So people who are interested in that can get that from me.
Wonderful. And there's a question in the chat room. Someone had come in and left again, and there were a couple of books that you had been mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just give us a refresher in those few books?
Well, first there's Patrick Flanagan's Pyramid Power. You can find old copies on Amazon, although some of them are really expensive. And then there's Peter Lemazurier's The Great Pyramid Decoded, which is, there are two versions on Amazon. One is the pictorial version, and one is the more literary version, which people should read. I mean, it's a masterpiece of work. It's unbelievable.
And which is the one you were saying some of the prophecies you'd read already?
The prophecies are in Peter Lemazurier's The Great Pyramid Decoded.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah.
And David, thank you so much. Is there anything you want to add about the pyramids before we wrap up? I have one more question for you.
You know, no. I think the only thing that really disturbs me is if the builder could prophesy Christ's birth in the Bethlehem line, the Bethlehem angle, and many other places in the pyramid, and that Jesus was obviously a student, an architectural student of the pyramids along with his father, I really ask how great these beings were who built it, and how it escaped us that, I mean, my experience of Christ is his consciousness is the whole thing. He is so great. He is so supreme. He's too powerful of a being to really visit human beings. We're very weak, very low voltage beings. But how great were the builders and the architects to know that he was going to be born even thousands of years after they completed the pyramid is way beyond me. That's the last thing I have to say.
Wonderful, thank you. And so, David, I'm curious about your crystal necklaces,
mm-hmm.
something that I've been wondering for a while now. In the pictures of the PDF file that you sent me and also on your website, you show the way that you measure the electronic frequency
mm-hmm.
while you're just on your own and then while you're holding the crystal.
Mm-hmm.
But I noticed that you're holding the crystal in your hand, touching the little wires to the crystal.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that you're not wearing the necklace as you normally would?
Well, because if you, for one, it's a great question. When you touch it, your nerves are plugged into it. So you're going to get a way higher reading than if you just wear it. And that's why, Marie, we did the aura camera test as well, because I wanted to make sure that increase in energy was not only on that nerve by itself. Like, let's say you have an increase in voltage on the nerve that you're testing, but it's not going anywhere else in the body. And that is true because the aura camera shows, like, we have one guy at a trade show you'll see in the ebook. He's holding the pendant in his right hand, and there's a big, bright blue light on that right hand's aura. But, you know, then there are other people who, when they're wearing it, their whole aura changes dramatically just from wearing it. But that the aura camera is picking up more subtle energy vibrations than the voltmeter. We've done tests with, let's say, a person with 5.0 or lower on the millivoltmeter. They will hold one of our pendants for 2 or 3 minutes and let it go and then retest, and they're higher. And they're not even holding it anymore. But to the levels that you get to when you're plugged into it, I also tested a transistor, one of the early Fairchild transistors, on my fingertips, and it raised me quite a bit, but nowhere near as much as my pendant on full nerve contact. Now, if I were to wear the transistor around my neck, it might do something. But it's not about the increase in energy, as in it's about the information that we're vibrating. Like, I can vibrate the frequencies of the pyramids or the phi ratio or the sound of the sun into a crystal pendant. And because crystals can be used as hard drives, they have excellent memory, vibrational memory especially. So to me, it's more about the information, which is very, very subtle, just like meditation is very subtle, that's slowly getting into your nervous system from wearing it, as opposed to trying to just raise my millivolts. Because I can raise my millivolts other ways, but I can't get that very, very perfect mantra information in the body without touching or wearing it. Like the first transistors, they thought, because they could see all these free electrons floating on the surface of the crystal, if they ran a wire just over the surface of the crystal, they would pick up the electrons like passengers, and you would have a little amplifier. It didn't work unless the wire was touching the crystal. The silver wire that wraps around our pendants, the solid silver, is touching the crystal. When you put the electrode from the voltmeter, also measuring microamps, which also go up on the microamp meter, it has to actually touch between the silver and the crystal. And if you do that without adding your fingers, you won't get anything on the voltmeter. But as soon as you add the human body voltage, it works exactly like the transistor, right in that little gap. But yet people who wear them constantly, like I had a guy write me yesterday, say that he broke his pendant and he hasn't had it for 3 days, and he feels like he's losing, he has no energy, he can't believe that the pendant was giving him that much energy, and he's like, I need to get another one right away because I can't stand this. People can feel it, especially when they wear it for a while and they don't wear it for a while. Then they wear it for a while and they don't wear it for a while. Millivolts is very, very subtle. But remember, the transistors today in the Intel chip are weaker. The increase in energy they're causing in the Intel chip are far weaker than these pendants are raising your vibration on full contact. Now, when you're wearing it, you're not in full contact, but you are wearing it around the heart. And the heart produces the strongest magnetic field in the body. And because it's right next to the crystal, it's going to share the information of the crystal with the body, with the bioelectric field of the body. And every time we do aura camera testing, you will see a change, depending on how sensitive a person is, of course. There are some people that have very little sensitivity, and the amount of change will be less than another person in response to it. You know, they don't make you enlightened. They help you meditate. They help you get into deeper states easier. Just like if you were a yogi meditating in a cave in India where there's all these streams and rivers going by and you carrying all these incredible minerals and energies, and then you try to go meditate in Manhattan in an apartment, the difference is astoundingly different. Mm-hmm. Jesus and Moses meditating in the Great Pyramid versus meditating outside, it's going to be very different. So the stone technology is very facilitative.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for explaining that so clearly, David. And some people are asking again about your website, please.
My website is lightstreamtechnologies.com for both the wand and my pendants. That's lightstreamtechnologies.com. And you can email me at David, S-E-R-E-D-A, @hotmail.com.
Wonderful. And is there anything you want to add before we close the show? It's been such a pleasure talking to you. How is it being a dad? It's been a while since we
Well, it's a wonderful thing. My daughter started walking and running around, and it just happened so fast.
Aww.
And she got her first flu, which was a really bad one.
Ooh.
She got up to 100. Somebody came over to the house carrying a really bad virus, and they were coughing all over the living room, and we moved them out of here, but she got sick, and she went up to 104, and, you know, it's very, very, very hard on us to see her first flu go so high. But she fought it off naturally, and it's funny, we took her to the emergency ward, because when she hit 104, I was really concerned, and she just barfed up all the medicine. And they said, oh, my God, children really love this medicine because it's candy-flavored, and she was just screaming and barfing it all over them. So we took her home and did everything naturally. And it took a while, but she got better.
Aww.
And she, you know, children are amazing. They're so happy when they get better. They're just in a higher state of ecstasy because they're not suffering anymore. And they didn't really know that much suffering was possible prior to their experience. But they just let it go, you know, so quickly. She's just right back to, you know, smiling and laughing and zipping around the house.
Aww.
There's a good lesson there.
All right, David. Well, thanks so much for your time today. I'm sure you've got lots to get done and continuing on your amazing research. But please do keep us posted, and we'll have you on again sometime soon.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, have a great day.
Have a good day.
You too. All right. So that was David Sarita, and this has been Namaste Radio. And I'm your host, Marie Bernard. Thank you so much for being with us. Please do join us online at namastepublishing.com, where there is a whole global community. You can also follow us on Twitter at Namaste Books, and there is a page where you can interact on Facebook, Namaste Publishing, there on Facebook. So thank you so much for being with us today. Have a wonderful day. Be well, and namaste.
Thank you for joining with us for this hour of Namaste Radio. For further spiritual insights and sharing, please join us in Namaste Global Community at namastepublishing.com. If you enjoyed the show, please add Namaste Radio as a friend, favorite the show, and tell someone about it. Sharing this show is a precious gift that's completely free. Thank you. May you enjoy each moment of your day. Namaste.